characters and all the relationships and all the things going on. You were telling the story, this happened, then this happened, then this happened. And now I'm going to go back and tell you that something that happened in between. That's what today's chapter is like. So these are things that have been led up to from many of the earlier chapters. For example, Krishna leaving Vrindavan and all of the heartbreak that accompanied that, especially amongst the gopis, that comes to a conclusion today. And Krishna's separation from his birth mother and father, quote unquote, Devaki and Vasudev, it doesn't come to a conclusion, but it's deepened. You know, that whole experience or that whole situation where he was born here, but he was raised over here by another set of parents. So those parents come together today. And the different, very subtle relationships that Krishna has with each of them become more pronounced. So this event takes place after the or before the Rajasuya sacrifice, which we just read about yesterday. The Rajasuya sacrifice was the culmination of Yudhisthira's brief period of happiness as the king of Indraprastha before they were sent into exile. And that exile and then led to the Kurukshetra War. So all of this took place actually quite a bit earlier in Krishna's life. This convergence of the Yadus and the Kurus, essentially, coming together, or the followers of Nanda Maharaj, and the residents of Mathura, the residents of Vrindavan, the residents of Dwarka, the residents of Vrindavan, all of them coming together at Kurukshetra for this Sangha. So, that is part... Oh, and also, of course, Devaki's dead children, the children that were killed. You know, such a horrific incident in Krishna's early life. His six siblings. So all of that is also elucidated and cleared up. So that's the denouement. Before we go to reading, I'd like to ask you to turn over to verse number 47 on page 365. This is a very famous verse in Srimad Bhagavatam, which Srila Prabhupada quotes very often. Yat tirtha buddhi shalene nakari chich janeshu abhigeshu swa eva gokara. The things that an ignorant person thinks. First of all, he thinks that his body, which is a bag of mucus, bile, and air, is himself. And then the place where he was born is a holy place of pilgrimage. But the actual holy place is a pilgrimage. He goes there only to take a bath. And not to talk to the saintly persons who live there. And finally, and a person who thinks this way is and his family is going to save him from all calamities. That person is compared to a cow or an ass. So a cow is generally a very sacred animal, and it would seem to be a flattering comparison. But in terms of their intellectual capacity, they are not on the top of the evolutionary chart. So cows and asses are comparable in intelligence to such a person. Anyway, this is a famous verse, so we'll read all this. Okay? Chapter 27. In Kurukshetra. Reunion. O king, let us continue with an incident before the Rajasuya sacrifice and Kurukshetra war. Lord Krishna's priests in Dwarka advised a royal trip to holy Kshetra for an imminent eclipse. The mighty sage Parasaram once dug five sacred lakes and held the rites to sanctify that famous holy place. The sun's eclipse gave people far and wide a welcome chance to go there on a pilgrimage and spiritually advance. Lord Krishna's entourage went there with pomp and majesty. The chariots his soldiers rode seemed almost heavenly. Their elephants were huge as clouds. Their horses' rhythmic gait made Krishna and his well-dressed clan appear to levitate. The saintly Yadus reached the lakes took baths, and kept a fast. They next gave gifts to Brahmins till the proper time elapsed. Observing Vedic rites, they bathed again and fed their priests while praying for devotion to Lord Krishna's lotus feet. The Yadus broke their fast with Krishna's personal consent and sat beneath some cooling shade trees, tranquil and content. By now, 1,000 kings had come, both friends and enemies. Somewhere among them, Nanda led the cowherd families. Soon countless glad reunions made all hearts and faces bloom. For most men relished friendships they were eager to resume. The smiling groups of women, breasts adorned with saffron paste, pressed hard against each other as they tearfully embraced. The young bowed to the elders, and the elders blessed the young. Formalities completed, talks of Krishna danced on tongues. When Kunti met her brother, Vasudeva, her sorrow fled. Addressing him and many other relatives, she said, "My dear respected brother, through my long calamities, I feel I've been forgotten by my loving family. You're one of many Yadu saints. I see that on your face. Yet everyone abandons those devoid of heaven's grace." Said Vasudeva, "Dear sister, we are ordinary men. Dispersed by Kamsa's terrors, we've at last come home again. Regardless if one's free or ruled by despotic demands, he's nothing but a plaything in the Lord's almighty hands." The Yadus honored all the kings attending the event, who turned their eyes to Krishna and at once became content. Though different views among the different monarchs was the norm, they all became enchanted with Lord Krishna's love by the mind, speak and walk and eat with he who makes our goal of life in heaven obsolete. When Nanda learned the Yadus and Lord Krishna had arrived, he went at once to see them with his carts and friends and wives. Like lifeless bodies coming back to life, they all appeared delighted to embrace each other after many years. When Vasudeva embraced King Nanda, joyful as he was, he couldn't help recalling all the grief that Kamsa caused. Then Balaram and Krishna, whom he'd left in Nanda's care, embraced their foster father and choked up in tearful prayer. As Yashoda and Nanda held their foster sons again, they felt the pain of separation vanishing within. The men went elsewhere, leaving Rohini and Devaki to say these words to Yashoda, who listened joyfully. "You've shown us both more friendship than we ever could forget. With all the wealth of Indra, we could not repay our debt. You gave our sons security, your love, and all supplies, protecting them in childhood, as the eyelids shield the eyes." The gopis, who condemned their eyelids, now enjoyed the chance to drink the sight of Krishna to the threshold of a trance. More focused than a yogi, they stood still and stared ahead. Lord Krishna, laughing, came to them, embraced each one, and said, "My dear beloved girlfriends, do you still remember me? I've been off killing demons to protect my family. Do you think I'm ungrateful and resent me in your hearts? Why, God alone unites us and takes us far apart. As winds assemble cloud banks, shreds of grass and grains of dust, then scatter them again, so God has dealt with all of us. And should you think that changeable, erratic God is me, because of your devotion, I've become your property. How could we be apart if I pervade all living beings, as elements like earth and air pervade all mortal things? And since you know yourselves as spirit souls eternally, you surely see both matter and the soul exist in me." Displeased with theoretical connections with their Lord, the gopis said, "Your words of wisdom certainly afford the shelter of your lotus feet for mystics and the wise, but how can we mere village girls attain that matchless prize?" The gentle guru of the cowherd girls, for whom they lived, went on to visit Yudhisthira and other relatives. When Krishna asked these relatives for news about their lives, They all felt very purified and happily replied, "The nectar saints dispense when they describe your lotus feet intoxicates us when it fills our ears. Yes, it's that sweet. Resplendent in your human form, you teach and dispel the miseries of life. As such, how could we not be well?" Krishna's queens speak. As Yudhisthira and others praised Lord Krishna's qualities, Lord Krishna's wives spoke with the Pandavas, Queen Draupadi. She asked them, "How did Krishna make you all his loving brides when he portrayed a common man?" Each wife, in turn, replied, "Rukmini, when many kings had come to see me marry Shishupal, Lord Krishna kidnapped me and proved himself the best of all. He seemed to be a lion chasing goats to get his prey. May I forever worship he who carried me away." Satyabhama, "Satrajit, my dear father, owned the Shyamantaka jewel. Distraught about his brother's death, he acted like a fool and tried to blame Lord Krishna, who exposed his great offense. My father then betrothed me to the Lord to make amends." Jambavati, "Not recognizing Krishna as Lord Ram, his deity, my father, Jambavan, fought Krishna quite exhaustively. When he could not defeat the Lord, he realized who he was and offered me as recompense for troubles he had caused." Kalindi, "Lord Krishna understood that I performed austerity in hopes I'd gain a grain of dust from underneath his feet. As man and wife, we now live in his palace, and what's more, he kindly lets me serve him as the sweeper of his floor." Mitravinda, "My Swayamvara Yajna brought in kings from many lands, but Krishna crushed them all, like a lion won my hand. My foolish brothers cursed at him, yet I became his wife. Today I pray to wash his lotus feet life after life." Satya, "My father had arranged for 7 deadly bulls to test the kings who asked to marry me, and thus find out the best. Lord Krishna made me happy when he effortlessly tied those fearsome bulls who devastated many heroes' pride." Bhadra, "Aware I had reposed my heart in Krishna long before, my father gave me to him as his bride, and he gave more, a military guard of many 1,000 men of worth. I pray to serve Lord Krishna anywhere I may take birth." Lakshmana, "By hearing sages speak of Krishna, I became attached. My father, understanding this, arranged a royal match in which the archer had to string a superhuman bow and pierce a target on the palace ceiling from below. The target was quite hard to hit and only could be shot by using the reflection in a single water pot. To string the bow was hard enough. 1,000 monarchs tried, but only 7 managed, as the rest were all denied. The great Arjuna strung the bow and fired a well-aimed shot. Although his was the closest try, he merely grazed the spot. When all the humbled kings gave up, Lord Krishna strung the bow, glanced in the pot, and shot his arrow right where it should go. The gods in heaven showered flowers. Everybody cheered, except some unsuccessful kings whose shame was too severe. Adorned in garlands, earrings, and fresh silk, my heart rejoiced. I placed a necklace on Lord Krishna, settling my choice. As drums resounded, conch shells blew, and men and women danced. The singers sang, delighted by this joyous circumstance. Some kings, however, fumed with lust, their royal egos bruised. The rest of us praised Krishna, but they stubbornly refused. He placed me on his chariot, protecting me from harm, put on his armor, drew his bow, and showed 2 extra arms. Like village dogs who chase a lion, some kings gave pursuit. How quickly they'd forgotten how precisely Krishna shoots. When many kings were killed or wounded, all the others fled. Our party rode to Dwaraka with Krishna at the head. He looked just like the sun god going home with a parade. My father gave us thrones and jewels, weapons, guards, and maids." As Lakshmana then realized she'd spoken quite a while, she promptly praised her co-wives with a shy, embarrassed smile. "By taking up austerities and giving up all else, we're blessed to be the maidservants who serve the Lord himself." Rohini, As soon as he killed Boma, Krishna found me and the rest of 16,000 princesses imprisoned and distressed. Because we'd always thought of him, though he'd had no desire, he married us and made us all his queens as we aspired. O saintly Draupadi, we do not wish to rule the earth. We do not aim for heaven, nor to end our death and birth. Like all Vrindavan's residents, we simply want instead the fragrant dust from Krishna's lotus feet upon our heads. As other Yadu ladies and the gopis came to see how Krishna's wives had married him in loving ecstasy, and how they served him faithfully so many different ways, their eyes swelled up with teardrops, and their hearts became amazed. Conversing with the sages. As men and women gathered in respective groups and spoke, the greatest sages of the universe all came, provoked by eagerness to see Lord Krishna and Lord Balaram. The men bowed to the sages and stood up with folded palms. Lord Krishna and Lord Balaram and all the other kings poured water on the sages' feet and brought such offerings as drinking water, cozy seats, fine scents, and sandal paste. As Krishna rose to speak, respectful silence filled the space. You've made our lives a great success. Today we all have gained the audience of sages such as gods cannot attain. We common men see God just in our temples, nowhere else. How are we blessed to see and hear such sages as yourselves? A holy lake or river, like a temple deity, will only cleanse the heart if they are seen repeatedly. And worshipping the demigods will never make one clean. A saint, however, purifies as soon as he is seen. A man who thinks himself a bag of mucus, bile, and air, assumes his wife and loved ones will protect him from despair. He worships his hometown while using holy sites for baths, ignoring saintly persons like a foolish cow or ass. The sages sat in silence, quite confused by what they'd heard, for Krishna to defer himself to them seemed so absurd. Concluding he behaved that way to teach the common man, they knew just how to answer Krishna. Smiling, they began, "Remarkable, Lord Krishna, you've bewildered all our minds. You act just like a human being, perfectly refined, yet it is you who manifests and ends the universe as earth transforms to rock and dirt, the simple grown diverse. When you descend, the pious thrive, the wicked are undone, and you established Vedic truth by simply having fun. The Vedas are your spotless heart, the gateway to the truth, and thus you honor learned priests, though you are absolute. You cover your magnificence by mystic energy, confusing both the atheists and your own family. Illusioned by your power, they live on, forgetting you as sleepers dream of other realms, forgetting what is true. The holy cleansing Ganges water all springs from your feet, which yogis contemplate, though their attempt is incomplete. You only come to those who serve those feet wholeheartedly. We thus request this blessing. May we be your devotees. The sages, having spoken, were preparing to go home when Vasudeva approached them with a question of his own. O saints, if work makes karma, to which we are all subject, can further work release us from this damaging effect? Sri Narada said to the sages, Is it a surprise that Vasudeva inquires from us? Lord Krishna, in his eyes, is just a boy. He dwells upon the holy Ganges banks, yet goes away on pilgrimage to bathe in distant tanks. The Lord's complete awareness is consistent and sublime. Creation nor destruction of the universe, nor time, nor any other change can make it falter, shift, or slip. Yet Krishna keeps it covered, like the sun by an eclipse. The sages said to Vasudeva, as others listened in, Yes, work can counteract effects that other work begins. Authorities have shown that Vedic sacrifices will, by pleasing God and man, bring the effects of work to nil. The wise give up their urge for wealth by Vedic sacrifice, their urge to reproduce by undergoing family life, their urge for heaven through a whiff of instability, and all else leaving home to undertake austerity. You've satisfied your forefathers by bearing progeny, and satisfied the saints by scriptural acuity. You've paid two debts, but one remains. Consider our advice, and satisfy the gods by holding Vedic sacrifice. We've now addressed your question in the ordinary way by saying what a saintly person always has to say. O Vasudeva, in fact, we know how much you must have done in other lives to realize Lord Krishna as your son. Vasudeva performs yajna. The gracious Vasudeva paid his respects on hands and knees and asked the sages, please stay on as sacrificial priests. The sages, all agreeable, arranged the articles according to the strictest set of Vedic principles. Then Vasudeva and all the kings and queens went off to bathe. They dressed in fine new clothing, garlands, gems, and sandal paste. The queens brought in auspicious things as Vedic dancers danced. Musicians played, reciters prayed, and singers sang entranced. The priests anointed Vasudeva with butter. Very soon, surrounded by his 18 wives, he shone just like the moon encircled by a host of stars. The sages blessed them all by sprinkling them with water based on Vedic protocol. Though Vasudeva wore deerskin, all his wives wore silk and gold. The priests were also nicely dressed, and everybody glowed as if they were in Indra's world of endless opulence. Lord Krishna and Lord Balaram looked on, imbued with bliss. The priests directed Vasudeva to keep the fires alight and honor his transcendent son with all the proper rites. When everything was finished, Vasudeva gave all the priests donations, such as land and cows, and served a royal feast. Each diner, king or dog, ate well and greatly pleased himself. As Vasudeva and all his wives distributed their wealth, the time arrived for all the kings and sages to depart. They went home slowly, pained by separation in their hearts. King Nanda of Vrindavan, though, did not leave right away. The Yadus, Balaram and Krishna, honored him all day. Then Vasudeva, quite satisfied, took Nanda by the hand and spoke to him in front of the assembled cowherd clan. My brother, God has bound us all with knots of human love. Though mystics meditate and heroes struggle, push, and shove, they cannot stop affection. I am sure love is divine, for saints like you stay faithful to ungrateful hearts like mine. When Kamsa dispatched demons to assail you with abuse, I languished in his jail. Since then, I have no good excuse. I've blindly grown intoxicated by prosperity, and in my greed ignored the needs of friends and family. Remembering the unrelenting friendship Nanda kept, the self-effacing Vasudeva choked up and loudly wept. For his part, Nanda felt so much affection, he would say, "Tomorrow I must go," for the ensuing 90 days. King Nanda and the cowherds were reluctant, it appears, for Krishna had preoccupied their minds for many years. At last, their wagons loaded down with precious Yadu gifts, they headed for Mathura, though their pace was hardly swift. Their relatives departed, and the monsoons on the way, the Yadus went back home to Dwarka that very day. Ecstatic that the pilgrimage allowed them to attend the sacrifice of Vasudeva and see their long-lost friends. Vasudeva and his sons. Days later, Balaram and Krishna bowed to Vasudeva, recalling what the sages said and how his sons behaved. Their father was at last convinced of their divinity. He thus addressed them both by name and told them lovingly, O Krishna, Krishna, best of yogis, ceaseless Sankarshan, I know you have created the material pradhan, the universal elements of heaven, earth, and hell, though matter doesn't touch you when you manifest yourselves. Since you have fathered nature, everything that comes to be in any shape or fashion is your private property. Whatever piece of nature that appears before my view is for you, by you, from you, of you, and within you, too. And after making matter, you make everything compelled to move and grow and change and die by entering yourself within each atom as the super soul the life of all. The universe exists and breathes because you are thus installed. Both life and matter, varied as they are, arise from you, as does the brilliance of the sun, the glowing of the moon, the lightning's flash, the twinkling of a million stars at night, the permanence of mountains, and the earth's sustaining might. In water, your refreshment, taste, and sustenance combined. In air, your warmth and vigor of the body and the mind. You're down and up, you're left and right, within and all around. In all-pervading ether, you're the element of sound. You energize the senses and allow them to perform. Your speech, allowing sounds to gain the power to inform. Your reason, memory, and ego, and all that they bring. And your one unchanging substance in a world of changing things. Imprisoned in this world of ceaseless change, the foolish soul neglects to understand you, his sublime transcendent goal. Though blessed with healthy human life, without you he's bereft and wastes his chance to exit from the chains of birth and death. You keep such souls bound up with ropes of love, life after life. My body is myself, they think. I own my kids and wife. My wife and I believed you were our children taking birth when you were just arriving to relieve the troubled earth. O kindly Lord, I touch your feet for divine protection, the very feet that in the pain of sustained connection with birth and death, I am exhausted with all pretenses, enough, enough with all my cravings to please my senses. When we were trapped in Kongs's prison like beasts in cages, you said you'd been our son before in some former ages. You come and go like summer clouds. Throughout human history, no one can fathom your appearance and all its mystery. Lord Krishna thought, my father's role eludes Brahma, and yet the sage's word remind him of what I made him forget. I relish his paternal love. With that, he bowed his head, replying in a gentle, smiling voice. Lord Krishna said, dear father, everything you've said describes creation well, referring as examples to my brother and myself. Yet you and all the Yadu dynasty exemplify the oneness of existence, father, not just he and I. Although he looks as different as every living being, the bright eternal supersoul is one in everything. As water may appear or disappear in many shapes, the supersoul appears diverse in all that he creates. Rescuing Devaki's sons. Imbibing the impression that the Lord was someone else, Lord Krishna's father felt paternal love consume himself. Lord Krishna's mother Devaki, however, was distressed. She turned to her two sons, looked down, and tearfully expressed, O Krishna, Rama, masters of all mystics, lords of all, as I see you before me, I cannot help but recall the fact that, as your mother, it appears I gave you birth, when you, in truth, descend yourselves to liberate the earth. A fraction of yourselves is all it takes to build, maintain, and end the planets, stars, and outer space. Because success escorts whatever you decide to do, today, my lords, please contemplate what I now ask of you. When all your childhood studies at the Gurukul were done, I learned that you both rescued Sandipani Muni's son, directly from the realm of death. You surely know the fact that I lost my six sons to Kamsa. Could you bring them back? As Devaki requested, Balaram and Krishna used their mystic strength to find the boys that Kamsa had abused. Arriving in the nether regions, home to the deceased, they met the famous Bali Maharaj, his friends and priests. The demon Bali, long ago, usurped Lord Indra's throne, yet later freely gave to Krishna everything he owned. On seeing his beloved Krishna, Bali Maharaj stood up and bowed along with his entire entourage. He seated Krishna and his brother in his finest chairs and bathed their feet, dispensing sacred foot wash everywhere. He then presented clothing, jewels, food, and all his wealth, and then, as he had done before, he gave his very self. While grasping Krishna's lotus feet upon his chest and head, King Bali swooned in ecstasy. Then, tearfully, he said, Lord Krishna and Lord Balaram, I bow my head to you, the persons whom great yogis and philosophers pursue. We living beings rarely get to see you in this way, unless you choose to show yourselves as you have done today. When you appear, however, even demons such as me can set aside their pride to take the opportunity. Some demons grow adverse to you because they are misled, while others shun the truth, preferring ignorance instead. And others simply hate you, while still other fiends like me associate with you to build their own prosperity. Your mystifying energy covers up our eyes. Indeed, the greatest yogis cannot see through your disguise. Please take me to your lotus feet, where even I can find necessities from generous trees and saints of loving minds. But have I been too bold, my lord, presenting my desire? Have you come with a purpose? Is there something you require? To serve you supersedes all Vedic rites and cleanses sin. Please tell us what to do, my lord. We're eager to begin. Lord Krishna said, Marichi, a great sage, once had 6 sons who laughed at Lord Brahma because of something he had done. They thus took births as children of Hiranyakashipu, and then as sons of Devaki. They now live here with you. King Kamsa killed all 6 of them, and Devaki laments, We wish to stop this series of unfortunate events by ending all their suffering, and Devaki's as well, and sending them to heaven now that they have lived in hell. As monarch of the lower planets, Bali easily located and returned the 6 young sons of Devaki. Again he worshipped Balaram and Krishna, who then left for Dwaraka, where Devaki had so long felt bereft. When she saw her lost children, Devaki became possessed with such maternal love that milk cascaded from her breasts. She let the babies drink that milk, which Krishna once enjoyed. Then, tenderly, she sniffed the head of each beloved boy. Entranced by Krishna's powers of illusion, Devaki saw each young baby reassume his past identity. The 6 became the gods they'd been before they misbehaved, and bowed before Lord Krishna, Devaki, and Vasudeva. The saintly Devaki was struck with wonder and deduced she'd just seen an illusion that Lord Krishna had produced. Amazing as it was for him to save his mother's sons, Lord Krishna showed us countless marvels. This was merely one. This pastime of Lord Krishna sanctifies the universe. A devotee will decorate his ears with every verse. If one repeats or hears about the wonder Krishna showed, his mind will dwell on Krishna, and he'll gain the Lord's abode. Olivia, if I could have just a moment before you speak. Just wanted to refer back to this speech by Vasudev, beginning on page 368. You see, so here Vasudev gives a very strong philosophical speech about why Krishna is God. And how does Krishna respond? Does he like it? Does he say, thank you very much? No, he gives him some kind of like almost Mayavadi philosophy. He says, oh yes, you're seeing us as God, but actually God isn't everyone, is the super soul. Just like water takes different shapes according to the vessels that it's in, so the super soul is in everyone. So you're just simply seeing the super soul in us. He gives him this kind of Mayavadi stuff. Anything to prevent him from having this awe and reverence mood, because what Krishna wants is the parental affection. And you notice also very briefly that Nanda and his family, just they never got into this stuff. They just went back. See, and all the coward men, they just went back very sad. But Krishna stayed with Devaki and Vasudev and had all of these discussions to try to bring Vasudev to the same level that Nanda was already at. So there's some nuances in there, different rasas of parental love. Okay, Olivia.
Hare Krishna. I just wanted to first thank Kalakanta Prabhu for glorifying Krishna with all this beautiful poetry that we get to read every morning. And also thank him for allowing me to speak and give class despite all my disqualifications. So first I wanted to talk about how when Krishna returns to Vrindavan, or when the inhabitants of Vrindavan first see the members of the Yadu dynasty, and they're such intimate friends, they're so excited to see each other. In the Krishna book, it mentions that they felt extreme ecstasy and tears fell down from their eyes, and they dove into the ocean of material happiness. And it goes on to say, Srila Prabhupada explains that the only reason this is possible is because they're all fixated on Krishna, and all of their talk with one another is all focused around Krishna. So they're able to be spiritual friends and not just material friends like we make all the time here. So we must follow in the footsteps of the Yadu dynasty and the cowherds of Vrindavan in order to make spiritual bonds with people and make attachments like that and focus our relationships on Krishna. It also mentions that they've been freed from the material anxieties because they have devoted their lives to serving Krishna, which has given them perfect knowledge and renunciation, which has allowed them to control their minds to always be fixed on Krishna. So in reading this, I kind of noticed that there are steps to devotional life, and it starts off with just living in devotion, and then in return you'll get this perfect knowledge, and then your mind will always be fixated on Krishna. So for me, I think it's been important to not try to force my mind being fixated on Krishna, but rather just focus on perfecting my devotion. And I haven't had a lot of time, or I haven't had as much time as I'd like to read, so maybe that's because I'm not ready for this perfect knowledge yet. But thank you for letting me do this, because I learned a lot through this reading. So it goes on to say that any activity, or I concluded, I guess, that any activity or action we take should be for Krishna. So if our actions are always, and this kind of reflects back onto the steps of devotional life, if our actions are always centered around Krishna, then our minds will also be fixated on him. So like as an example, I thought of like, if I were to force myself to chant my rounds, but not really put my heart into it, my heart would not be in it if I were to force myself to chant my rounds and then go out and break regulative principles and not follow the rules and regulations. My mind would be agitated, and I would be doing things centered around myself and not for Krishna, and this is why I would be having to force myself to chant my rounds rather than feeling motivated and really being attached to chanting. So then when Krishna first sees the gopis again, they haven't seen him in a while, and it's said that the gopis cursed Brahma for making eyelids, which blinked, because they were so attached to Krishna they can't tolerate not seeing him. So I thought that was really sweet. And I was kind of thinking about how we should kind of curse that we have to sleep, because we can't. When we sleep, unless we're dreaming of Krishna, it's kind of, I know I have a lot of just dreams not about Krishna, and I don't like it, but and then as soon as it says, he wrote, as soon as he became visible, they took him inside their hearts through their eyes. So they started feeling this intense ecstasy, and they were crying, and all the hair stood up on their bodies. But they weren't even embracing him physically. It was just, they were just seeing him. So it's really amazing that we have these deities and all these pictures of Krishna, and we have these other devotees to remind us of Krishna, so that we're able to embrace him with our eyes, with our ears, with our chanting, with all of our senses. And we don't actually, a lot of times people have trouble with spirituality because it's something you can't see. But we're so fortunate to have all of these things that we can absorb ourselves in, so that we can see Krishna through all of our different, with our minds, and we can embrace him with our minds. So Oh, so then it goes on to say, in the Krishna book, also this is the verse of the month where it says, fortunately, you have developed loving affection for me, which is the only way to achieve the transcendental position of association with me. Any living entity who develops such unalloyed devotional affection for me certainly at the end goes back home, back to Godhead. In other words, unalloyed devotional service and affection for me are the cause of supreme liberation. So Srila Prabhupada goes on to explain that the process of devotional service is the revival of Krishna consciousness. So I was just thinking about this. It's not necessarily like I'm going to force myself to be Krishna conscious every moment, but rather I want to be Krishna conscious, and therefore every moment I'm striving to be Krishna conscious. Because unless we're seeing Krishna everywhere, literally every moment of our lives,